It's March 6, 1970, Greenwich Village, New York. Terry Robbins is sitting in the basement of a townhouse. He's 22 years old.
And by most accounts, he's a charismatic young man, the kind who draws you in with careful words and a firm but welcoming presence. And he's bright. But there's something about Terry. Maybe something in his upbringing or someone he met along the way that leaves him uneasy. Something that leads him to that basement, sitting at a workbench surrounded by dynamite to build a bomb.
Whatever it is, on that brisk Friday morning, in that brick home on West 11th Street, it went terribly wrong.
This luxury brownstone exploded in New York's Greenwich Village. Police believe the house was in fact a bomb factory for the Weather Underground, a radical offshoot of the Students for a Democratic Society, known for its opposition to the Vietnam War.
The explosion shakes the whole block. Floors of the townhouse collapse, and the building is ablaze. Somehow, two people survive and escape. But three others die in the townhouse that day. One of them is Terry. They were all part of a radical left group that had spread to cities across the U.S.
People calling themselves members of the Weather Underground last night planted bombs in federal office buildings in Washington and Oakland, California. The group, apparently an offshoot of the old radical weathermen of the 1960s, claimed the bombs were set to protest American support for South Vietnam and Cambodia. We have reports.
What had started as college students protesting the war in Vietnam eventually developed into wannabe militant groups. They called themselves the Weathermen. I'm Hugo Amador.
And I'm Brooke Witherow. This is Shoe Leather, an investigative podcast that digs up stories from New York City's past to find out how yesterday's news affects us today. This season, we're going to 1970 Greenwich Village. A townhouse suddenly explodes, and authorities discover that it's ground zero for the operations of the Weathermen, a radical group of young revolutionaries who use violence to, as their slogan says, bring the war home.
What pushes a protest movement towards violence? What makes a group of mostly middle-class, college-educated young men and women to decide to build a bomb?
This is Shoe Leather Season 7, Revolution Gone Wrong.
You're listening to Episode 1, The Bomb Maker. We don't know much about Terry's early life. We know that he was born and raised in New York City. In his high school yearbook photo, Terry's slim, with a chiseled face and dark brown hair. And in many ways, he excels. He's in the honor society, he's a gifted ice skater, he likes to ski and play basketball, he falls in love with literature, and joins the student government.
He's only 16 years old when he graduates in 1964. He enrolls at Kenyon College in Ohio, 500 miles away from home. That's where he meets Peter Orengo.
While we often spoke about things that were political, we also talked about he loved music. He was fanatical about the groups that he championed.
But something Terry does not talk about is his family back home.
He lost his mother early on, and that was something that he felt deeply. But he was cautious, and he was actually very protective about his past. Well, at some point, I said, "You know, why? It's Ohio. Why are you here?" And he said, any place is better.
For the most part, Terry keeps a low profile his first semester at Kenyon. But he soon steps up into a more public role. Terry is elected president of the Students for a Democratic Society. It's a group on campus that focuses on issues like racial inequality and civil liberties. He starts organizing, trying to bring attention to the civil rights movement. He invites in all sorts of speakers. One of them is from the NAACP, who goes so far as to say, quote, "The apathetic American, the one who does nothing, is more damaging to the cause of civil rights than even the KKK.
It's a call to action. Terry urges the students to rally, to show up, to join SDS activities across campus. And he also wants the group to start focusing on another big issue, the Vietnam War.
The opposition to the war was not warmly received. It was a tough sell.
Tough, because Kenyon College has an active ROTC, a college program that trains students to become officers in the U.S. military after graduation.
His concern or his stance was that it was, you know, an essential element in the war machine, and that as long as it took, you know, able college students and turned them toward the practice of war, it was for him an obviously dangerous element in college life.
And Peter says Kenyon is a small college, less than 1,000 students. Everyone pretty much knows each other. So Terry's having a hard time getting the SDS to protest against their fellow students. He even tries to publish a newsletter called The Vanguard. Peter is his editor, but it only runs 2 issues.
And meanwhile, 250 miles north, at the University of Michigan, a man named Dickie Magadoff hears about Terry's efforts to organize on campus. Dickie is working with the Cleveland Economic Research and Action Project at the time. It's known as the EREP, a grassroots organization aimed at fighting poverty and racial inequality.
You know, the civil rights movement had been raging, and among other things, it needed white allies.
On a trip to Kenyon College, Dickie happens to bump into Terry. They bond over music.
We had this immediate connection around popular culture. One of the things that really stands out in my mind, he told me that first day, was that because the song Sounds of Silence had just come out, Simon and Garfunkel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
And it was quite a hit. I've come to talk with you again. You know, and I was just practically addicted to it. I would drive around and punch buttons on my radio looking for stations that were playing it. And he told me that when he was a high school junior or senior in Queens, that he used to go to these fraternity parties at Queens College, and these guys called Tom and Jerry would perform, and they were great, and it turned out they were Simon and Garfunkel.
Dickie takes a liking to Terry.
I mean, he had never been an activist, but he really knew a lot about what had been going on. He's very open, very enthusiastic, excitable to the point of brash. He had what to me seemed to be a great sense of humor in a movement that at the time seemed to be trending humorless.
Dickie invites Terry to join him on a tour of college campuses this summer. And Terry agrees. He spends the summer going around the country with Dickie and also doing community organizing back home in Queens. But when he gets back to Kenyon in the fall, he's frustrated. He's having a hard time recruiting people into the SDS. Mostly, he's getting pushback from other students. And so by the spring of 1966, the group is basically non-existent.
So Terry decides to make a change. He drops out of Kenyon, deciding to focus full-time on organizing and volunteering. He moves back to Cleveland to join Dickie and others at the ERAP. And it's there that Terry meets someone who will change the course of his life. In 1966, Bill Ayers is a teacher. He comes to Cleveland to start a preschool. And it's there that he meets 19-year-old Terry, who decides to volunteer at the school.
It was kind of love at first sight. I mean, I really found him fascinating, and he was intense about everything, and he had a lot of energy, and he was, you know, whip smart.
Bill and Terry spend a lot of time together. They even lived together briefly.
I think we probably had 6 or 8 people living in an apartment. And in those days, we were all amateurs.
When they're not working at the school, they're trying to advocate for welfare reform. Their goal is to raise money and organize rent strikes and marches. But Terry never loses sight of one of his main issues, the Vietnam War. And so he and Bill start to become more involved in the anti-war movement.
We kind of did a do-it-yourself kind of organizing campaign where we said, we're moving on to build the student movement, to build SDS, and we're designating Michigan and Ohio as a region that we took responsibility for. Then we drove from campus to campus, trying to both get chapters of SDS started, but also to energize existing chapters and bring them ideas about organizing and building the movement.
As they're trying to build up SDS, the U.S. is intensifying its efforts in the war. Over 500,000 troops are deployed. Over 16,000 American soldiers dead. 1968 is the bloodiest year of the war.
To leave Vietnam to its fate would shake the confidence of all these people in the value of an American commitment.
And then, in April of that year, something happens back in the United States that would change the country and embolden the SDS.
Memphis police report they have just confirmed that Reverend Martin Luther King has been shot.
Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated. And just a few months later...
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible?
Robert F. Kennedy was the leading Democratic presidential nominee and was assassinated too. The race for a new candidate begins. And Vietnam is a central issue.
The peace groups are demanding permission to march on Convention Hall the night the Democrats nominate their candidate for president.
The Democratic National Convention is held in Chicago that August. A number of leftist groups plan to protest, including the SDS.
Some of them were also determined to provoke a confrontation, to draw attention from the convention to the streets.
Terry and Bill arrive together in the middle of the protests, but things are starting to get out of control.
Thousands of protesters crowd in Chicago parks and streets.
Mayor Richard Daley vowed to keep it peaceful, even if it took force to keep the peace. He was backed by 12,000 police, 5,000 National Guardsmen, 7,500 regular army troops.
It becomes a police riot.
Most delegates to this convention do not know that thousands of young people are being beaten in the streets of Chicago.
The police hit protesters with their nightsticks. They launched tear gas to disperse the crowds. Hundreds of protesters are arrested, dragged into the back of police vans. Terry had little experience with fighting. But he and Bill get caught up in the chaos.
Terry picks up a metal canister from the pavement. It's filled with tear gas. He throws it back at the police. He's running and shouting in the crowd. He's exhilarated. Chicago was life-changing for Terry. He's now got his first violent protest under his belt. And words no longer seem enough to start a revolution. SDS membership is exploding. There are tens of thousands of members at campuses across the country. At this point, Terry is focused on the chapter at Kent State University.
Kent SDS was very physical. It was really, you know, fist in the air, yelling, arguing with people. Not violently, though. I mean, nobody owned guns. Nobody was thinking about that. It was peace and justice. And Terry loved it.
Candy Knox is about 5 years older than Terry, who's 21 now. She's a graduate student at Kent State. Candy's house, known as the Haunted House, was a gathering place for students to help organize the anti-war movement.
And Terry helped us understand things. He helped us understand when we ought to take an action and when we ought to just have educational sessions.
By the spring of 1969, Kent State SDS is becoming more confrontational. Terry is at the helm, working closely with the student leaders. And unlike his time at Kenyon, Terry has a lot of support behind him. He encourages physical protest, rallies, marches. He wants action that confronts everyday life.
One time, there was a spring fling or a prom or some kind of big dance at Kent. And Terry suggested that we organized to go in our raggedy old hippie clothes to walk in to the prom of all these people with gowns on and stand around, not say a thing, just stand around and watch them. Just be there, confront them. It was powerful. It was so powerful.
Terry writes several demands for the university administration in a pamphlet called The War at Kent State. He wants the ROTC abolished, the college program that trains military officers. It's the same fight he's been having since Kenyon College. He organizes a rally of 400 people in support of these demands. There's a fight between police and students. The administration responds by suspending SDS and charging several of its leaders with assault and battery. Terry writes, "Revolution begun."
The expelled SDS leaders have disciplinary hearings in front of the administration. This time, Terry leads 2,000 people in protest. About 700 of them march to the Music and Speech Building, where the hearing takes place.
So Music and Speech was locked. I guess the administration must have known that we were coming, and they got some fraternity guys, or I don't know who they were, big guys, to guard the door, and some of our guys fought with them a little bit, but then they just, you know, a couple of punches were thrown, let's put it that way.
The protesters make their way into the building. They successfully disrupt the hearing for the SDS leader.
Terry was relentless. The passionate Kent was relentless. And we weren't letting anybody slide. Not the cops, not anybody.
Police stop protesters on their way out of the building. Terry is arrested for trespassing because he's not a student and charged with inciting to riot. But he won't serve time until later this year.
We talked to about a half dozen people who knew Terry during this time. We were told over and over about how smart he was and dedicated to the cause. But people told us about a dark side too. Terry had a temper. At least two former SDS members said that Terry was sometimes violent towards his girlfriend at the time. And one thing we have heard about Terry's childhood was that his father was violent too.
People also told us that Terry is starting to become more of a leader in the greater SDS movement. The SDS is about to change too, in a major way. It's May of 1969, and Terry is working on a draft of a special edition of the SDS publication, The New Left Notes. He's writing a manifesto of sorts, laying out the future direction of the SDS.
So Terry was writing. We were sitting on the floor in the living room at the haunted house.
Candy was playing Bob Dylan's new record, Subterranean Homesick Blues, over and over again.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government.
And he was writing this paper and he was talking to me about it. And we decided that line, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. It's like, we don't need people from the left, people over 30, really, probably, to tell us how to make a revolution in our own country. This is us. This is our world.
Terry, along with Bill Ayers and several others, work on the SDS Manifesto. But Terry is the one to name it, after the Bob Dylan lyric, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows."
These are leaders of the nationwide youth organization that calls itself SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. It has more than 300 chapters on the college campuses of America. Its national and local leaders, in convention here at the Chicago Coliseum, June 1969, take the major credit for the rioting, mob actions, takeovers, and burnings on college and university campuses throughout the nation.
That June, the SDS is holding its national convention in Chicago. Some leaders, like Bill and Terry, are pushing a move from peaceful protest to something more. It's been 4 years of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, and they're growing more and more frustrated. Here's Bill Ayers again.
And we had done what we thought we were supposed to do, demonstrate, build huge mobilizations, organized not just on campuses, but in workplaces and neighborhoods. And yet, 6,000 people a week were being murdered by our government in the name of civilization and peace and well-being somewhere in the future. It was a lie then, it's a lie now, and we were determined to stop it. So, which way do you go? We were part of a group that was saying, here's how we should go.
The SDS is fracturing. Terry and Bill's part of the group want more militant action. The new manifesto calls on members to be willing to, quote, participate in the violent and illegal struggle.
The SDS ended its 7th annual convention yesterday in Chicago and accomplished little beyond a deep and bitter split between two factions.
By the end of the convention, this militant faction seizes control of the organization, and they have a new name for themselves, the Weathermen. Candy joins Terry and Bill as a member of the Weathermen. The group spreads to other major cities, trying to organize a revolution. But Candy is becoming more and more uncomfortable with it, with Terry.
And Terry was starting to go a little bit crazy. I mean, not insane. I don't mean that. I mean, he had spent some time in Chicago at the SDS National Office. And the police had raided the office while Terry was there. And they did some things to him that he really didn't explain to me, except this one thing of that they hung him out the window by his feet. And he became beyond angry and furious, and there wasn't any talking him down. I tried talking him down. I tried reminding him of where we had come from.
It doesn't work. It's October 1969. Terry turns 22. He travels back to Chicago. The Weathermen advertise a massive protest with the slogan, "Bring the War Home." It takes place during the trial of 8 people who protested during the Democratic National Convention of 1968. The Weathermen call on tens of thousands of people to show up. It won't be an ordinary SDS demonstration. But first, Terry has an idea. There's a bronze statue in Chicago. On the tall pedestal is a policeman, raising his right arm. Here's Bill again.
So it was a symbol of police power. And in that sense, it was kind of a perfect target to both rally around and pull down.
one of the weathermen places a crudely made bomb of dynamite between the statue's legs. The explosion knocks the entire statue off the pedestal. In a way, its explosion kicks off the several days of protests to come.
Now we have an out-and-out defiant gesture by groups that have come in here to upset the city. And we wonder now what'll happen. Now it's a statue. Will it be a policeman performing his duty tomorrow or what?
2 days later, their protests start. They rally and chant around a bonfire, then turn their actions to the streets. Gone are the days of peaceful protest. They plan to destroy. They smash buildings and car windows, but police start to barricade the city.
Power to the people!
Last night, they armed themselves with sticks and chains and rocks and surged through the streets of the Gold Coast on Chicago's north side to carry the fight to the enemy, the rich.
Terry and other leaders expect thousands, but only a few hundred show up. Police far outnumber the protesters.
From its beginnings as a mildly socialistic student organization to fight the draft, SDS has come down to this. A little band of middle-class radicals so carried away with their own rhetoric they believe they are staging a Maoist proletarian revolution.
Hundreds of weathermen are arrested. But they're not discouraged. After several days of demonstrations, they write a public statement. It's one battle after another, with white youth joining in the fight and taking the necessary risks. Pig America, beware. There's an army growing right in your guts and is going to help bring you down. This violent streak, especially Terry's, turns his friend Candy away.
I realized that there was no way I could calm him down. And that meant that I couldn't be a part of Weathermen anymore. Because if I couldn't trust Terry, couldn't trust Bill Ayers to be the people that I admired, I couldn't be a part of it. People were talking about guns, people talking about bombs, and I that wasn't me. I couldn't do that.
But Terry doesn't want to stop. And other people around him are starting to notice, like his friend and co-leader Mark Rudd, who he had met a few years earlier.
Terry was pushing a position that was, as I remember, something like the force of will. Do you want it enough? Do you want the revolution enough?
But as the weathermen are collecting themselves after the Chicago protests, there's another event that shakes Terry.
In Chicago today, two Black Panthers were killed as police raided a Panther stronghold.
In December, an FBI informant drugged a leader of the Black Panthers, which knocked him unconscious. Officers then stormed in and opened fire.
One of the dead was Fred Hampton, 22-year-old Illinois chairman of the Panthers.
Terry was devastated. When the rest of the weathermen also come to learn the news, they plan a war council in Flint, Michigan. But Terry can't join the rest of the weathermen in Flint. He has to return to Cleveland to serve his prison sentence for his involvement in the Kent State demonstrations. But Terry is released early.
I would say by January of 1970, Terry had become kind of a bully. And he bullied the rest of us into, do you have enough courage to do what needs to be done?
Like Andy, Mark becomes acutely aware of Terry's seemingly insatiable desire for violence.
You know, if you think about it, it's almost a fascist notion, which is the problem of violence.
For Mark Rudd, violence is easy. It takes very little to construct a bomb, for example. Nonviolence, however, requires moving mountains. It insists on the mobilization and gathering of millions of people. But that's what makes it so much more powerful. Peaceful protest takes time. And in Marx's words, a factor driving someone towards violence can simply be impatience.
A month later, Terry is in New York. He calls his then-girlfriend, Kathy Wilkerson, who is in Seattle. They met the summer of 1969, when Kathy had joined the Weathermen. He asks her if she wants to join him in New York City. She agrees and flies out. When they meet, Terry tells her that a small Weathermen collective has formed. He wants to introduce her. They're planning something, and they need a place to stay.
Kathy tells Terry her family is about to leave for a vacation in the Caribbean. They had a townhouse in Greenwich Village. It would be empty for the next week. And Terry asks Kathy if the group can use it in the meantime.
Kathy calls her father, tells him she is in New York and has come down with the flu. He agrees to let her stay, unaware that the Weathermen will be joining her.
In the several days there, they're busy collecting supplies, recruiting members. And then, on the morning of March 6, Terry sits at a workbench in the basement of the townhouse. Beside him is an old friend. On the next episode, we tell the story of the woman who joined Terry in the basement that day and what led her to her own demise.
Shoe Leather is a production of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. This episode was reported, written, and produced by me, Brooke Witherow.
And me, Hugo Amador.
Joanne Farrion is our executive producer and professor. Rachel Quester and Peter Leonard are our co-professors. Special thanks to Austin Mitchell, Brendan Klickenberg, Asta Chaturvedi, Dana Shivas, Zoe Chase, Brent Katz, and Columbia Digital Libraries.
Sources for this episode include Flying Too Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman by Kathy Wilkerson, Fugitive Days by Bill Ayers, and the Weather Underground documentary. A thank you to the Special Collections and Archives at Kenyon College and Kent State University.
Shoe Leather's theme music, Squeegees, is by Ben Lewis, Doron Zunes, and Camille Miller, remixed by Peter Leonard. Other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Our Season 7 graphic was created by Hope Shoe.